Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division meeting for January 12th, 2009. We do have a quorum, although, as I say, we're not going to be voting on any bills today. Today we're going to be looking at the Office of Enterprise Technology, and we're going to kind of, again, focus in on some of the transactions that they have, because they do a lot of business with virtually every other state agency. One of the things that they did not provide, but I did want to hand out, is this is, I believe, is their rate, the rates that they charge, the agencies, as they call them in, and you can kind of see if, and I don't understand a lot of these terms and so forth, but if you hire them to do stuff, this is what they will charge you by the hour or by the square foot or whatever. So something we may be wanting to talk about to get an idea of just how they interact with the other agencies and where the money is flowing between the state agencies. Anyway, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Gopal Khanna. I'm the CIO for the state of Minnesota. I'm here representing today the Office of Enterprise Technology, the state's lead agency, responsible for providing services, information technology services to state agencies as well as other government entities. We really appreciate this opportunity to be here today. And as we begin, just want to take a moment to introduce some of my associates who will be testifying as well today. To my right is John Lally. He's the Director of Planning and Portfolio Management for the Office of Enterprise Technology. I also have along with me two other associates, Chris Busey. He's the state's Chief Information Security Officer. He'll be testifying on security issues, as well as the CFO of the Office of Enterprise Technology, Larry Freund. He'll be talking about rates and our finances as well. So we have an extensive agenda for you today. Let me go through that agenda in over here, basically covering not only our services, our mission and vision, but also our direction, overall direction, and our, again, based upon your request, focus on finance and the rates as well. Having said that, members, Mr. Chairman, what we focus on is our vision is basically to make government better by leveraging technology, information technology, so that our agencies can be more effective in serving the citizens. And our mission is to basically become a provider of choice so that we have services that are based upon best practices, best delivery mechanisms, best value for our customers within state government. To take us forward, what I've asked is to have John Lally first go through some of the overview and planning aspects of our organization, followed by comments from our CFO and then Chief Information Security Officer. If I may, please.
Sure, Mr. Lally. Welcome to the Budget Division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Lally from the Office of Enterprise Technology. Before I get into the my portion of this presentation, I wanted briefly to talk about the four areas that OET operates in. One of our areas we're required to do by statute is the leadership area, includes the areas that are on the screen, IT policy and planning, enterprise governance and security and training. We also have a compliance and standard function also by law, which is about IT products and standards, contract and vendor management, security policy and security compliance and audits. Portfolio management, and in line with that, we are responsible for producing a report that will be coming to you later this week on the state's assets and expenditures, the systems and applications that we have for the state, and also the investments that have been made in previous years. And then we do project and investment oversight for systems that are appropriated for or otherwise funded within state government. We have marketplace services, which are going to be largely the topic for today, which are the services that are provided in the computing services, security services, web services, and data center management. And these are the areas that are paid by user rates. Like any private industry, our customers pay us for the goods and services that we deliver. And this consists of most of the budget for OET. And then finally, there are utility services that we provide to the state and to other parties, including voice, video, and data, and enterprise email, that are not in the nature of specific services to individual agencies, but rather services to the whole of the enterprise. Our strategies that we have in our strategic plan that we renewed this past fall, first of all, is to transform OET to be a provider of choice. We recognize that agencies have other alternatives that are open to them. We believe that our offerings are both price and quality competitive with the private sector and with other options that are open to them. But we also bring some other strengths to the table, and I'll talk about those in a minute. Second strategy that we have is to rebuild our customer-facing processes and channels of communication. And if that word rebuild sounds a little strange, it's because we recognize we had, over time, as monopolies do, and we were for many years a monopoly, we tended to get out of touch with the customers. And so we reestablished that through a more robust governance process and an ongoing dialogue with the agencies to make sure that we're offering them the services they want at the prices that are competitive and at a quality that meets their needs. We also have to improve our financial systems, which includes the clarity of the rate structure so that it is responsive and understandable. We need to advance, realistically, a limited number of high-priority enterprise service initiatives in the coming years to try to make things within government run more efficiently and allow agencies to concentrate on the reasons why they exist, the real business of state government. Business of state government is not technology. It is public service, public safety, public education, and things like that. And so we want to provide the basis for them to concentrate on their areas of business while we are in the background, much like public utilities are now. You turn on a faucet, you expect water. You turn on a light switch, you expect light. We want to do a lot more in the utility area for all the agencies and make it unnecessary for them to essentially create parallel processes for those. And finally, we want to do a better job of managing the internal and external IT governance processes with the agencies we serve and also the agencies over which we have some oversight responsibility under the law who may or may not be direct customers of ours. Things we're trying to do to improve and meet these strategies are going ongoing as we speak. We're trying to maintain a posture of continuous quality improvement within OET. We're trying to achieve an element of strategic budget stability. In the current environment, there's a lot of unknowns. I know this has come as a surprise to you, but we're trying to deal with those as well. And the agencies don't know what's coming in their future yet. Their customers and the programs they administer don't, and we certainly don't as a primary supporter and enabler of those agency businesses. So we're trying to make sure that whatever we do, we're going to be able to provide the basic services that they need and the quality they need to keep their state programs operating. And this is going to be a dynamic dialogue that's going to be going on for months and probably years now as we try to deal with the budget crisis. Our customer focus, we are, as I said earlier, we're trying to reshape our relationship with the agencies to more of a real partnership for mutual benefit so that we meet the quality requirements they have and do it in an efficient manner and cost-effective manner. We also believe that we have, using what's called a value equation, which is a more contemporary version of return on investment, if you will, and it looks beyond just financial to many other aspects, we believe our business value plus the competitive pricing makes us the vendor of choice for state government. Now we just have to convince all of our customers that that's the case. And finally, the governance that I've mentioned before, which is making sure that our decisions are made with our customers and that we work with them rather than imposing on them the decisions that we make. Our goal is to create a sustainable and competitive service delivery model for OET. We know we have advantages over many other alternatives, both private sector and public sector alternatives, for the agencies that come to us for service now. We know generally the business side of the agencies that we support. We've been there for a long time. We work with them. We understand the public policy and public program aspects that they have to put foremost in their minds. So we understand the business. It's not a learning curve for us. We certainly know the technology side. We don't pretend to be experts in all technologies, but in the technologies that are important to our customers, we have considerable track record and demonstrated expertise. We share with them a commitment to public service. Certainly that's an advantage. We offer the advantage of continuity because, unlike many vendor relationships where every 3 years or 5 years or even 10 years, you have a complete changeover of vendors and you go through the learning curve and the migration issues, we're here and we have always been here for the agencies that we serve. We offer competitive price package. We do on a regular basis, I think probably every 4 to 6 years on average, do a comprehensive benchmarking. We bring an independent expert in to review our costs and our operating mechanisms and our practices and let us know where we're deficient. I'm happy to say that for most of those, we've shown that our prices are competitive, our service quality is competitive, and that we would like to do it more often, but frankly, it's a very expensive process to have somebody do that kind of comprehensive analysis. So it's been a few years since we've done that. But as soon as time permits, we will be doing it again. And we don't pay sales tax. So we have, right off the top, a competitive cost advantage against many of the private sector service providers. What's going to be driving us? First of all, this ongoing objective assessment of our needs and our own capabilities. We're not relying on what we think we know. We're actually asking people and listening. And we're hearing things that aren't always making us happy about the quality of the service or the fact that we're responsive as we should be, but we're getting a lot better at it. Governance process is certainly helping out in that respect. We're looking at industry norms. There are published norms for many of the services that we offer. They may not be exactly equivalent to what government offers to government, but they're close enough that we get an order of magnitude relationship for many of these kinds of services. We have a very experienced staff, not only in OET, but in the agencies that we work with and partner with, and we want to take advantage of their skill and experience whenever possible. We have embraced a regimen of planning both at the enterprise level in the master plan and at the agency level with their strategic information systems plan, which will be coming to you as part of the portfolio report, and also at our own OET level with our strategic planning and our information planning. And we've adopted discipline change process. I don't know, I don't want to throw acronyms at you, but if you know anything about ITIL or COBIT, these are information management disciplines that are commonly accepted around the world. We're imposing the discipline and the tools that support the discipline within OET as a way of organizing and gaining greater efficiency and also in enabling us to benchmark against others. Our base operating budget is in three categories, and I hope this shows up clearly enough. There's a very small wedge. 2% of our operation is general funded basic operations. This includes the oversight and leadership functions of OET. Another 6% is general fund security, the special appropriations for enterprise security that Chris Boozy will address shortly. The remaining major portion of our budget, 92%, is from the Enterprise Technology Fund, which is a revolving fund, and that's where rates are paid for services, and like any other business, we depend on their revenues and they depend on our services, and that's where the most of our budget comes from, and it's also where most of our costs go. And we're going to talk about, Larry's going to talk about in just a moment, about the rate-based system, and it's essentially, it's a volume and usage relationship that's identified every year. How much usage is there of storage, of communications bandwidth, of processing cycles on the mainframe, of server capacity? The chart the chair held up earlier, the rate chart, is actually a summary, and we'll explain why that's a summary in just a moment. But it's an extraordinarily complex process. It takes nearly a year to get through, and it's highly dependent upon things like the accuracy of our predictions and the agency's predictions about what they're going to need from us in the coming year, which in turn depends on service volumes that they deliver through their programs. The other 8% on enterprise security and planning and oversight, we're prepared to address to whatever degree you want to, but my understanding is most of your interest today is in the rate-based components of it, not in the small piece of it that is general funded. So I will ask Larry Freund to come up. Larry is our chief financial officer. Whoops, I'm doing this backwards, and I apologize. And Larry will take you through the rate setting process, and we could talk then about what are some of the issues in the rate setting process that may be of interest to you and certainly are of interest to us. So, Larry.
Mr. Chair and Senators, my name is Larry Freund. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for OET. And what I will do is, as John mentioned here, was to go through, it's pretty much a high level of the rate setting process that we do here. Like John said, we spend a good part of the year, every year, developing this package, again, based on what our customers need and what we can provide for them for services for, in the IT field. So let's start out with our, you know, we are, again, a chargeback, or you hear different terms. You hear revolving fund, internal service fund, but we basically provide a service and we charge a fee, and our customers pay us based on a monthly invoice we send out. What we want to do in this process here, our main goals in this is to provide quality service at a competitive rate. One of the areas that we really like to focus on, but again, that was mentioned earlier, is it's hard to get the data. Very costly to get the data is, but we want to provide a service at a good price, but we want to compare that to what the private sector would do on that. So we're continually trying to make the rates as low as we can, but provide, again, we have to provide the quality service that the customers expect and want. We recover our service costs at a break-even rate. That's, in general, what we want to try to do is a break-even rate on that. And that fluctuates. Again, we have expenses change throughout the year. Sometimes volume, the projections aren't accurate, right on target sometimes here, up or down. So that has an effect on how we end the year. One of the big key areas is that we have to meet the federal and state requirements for consistent rates across all agencies. I can't set up a rate to charge DOT for, let's just say, phone service. I can't charge them one rate and then DHS another rate or any of our rates. We have to have one rate consistent across all users, and that the federal government really looks at that, because if we don't do that, they basically have a rule of thumb that says they get the lowest rate no matter what we charge, no matter who we charge for this. So, and then if we don't charge the same rates, they can also penalize us for that if there's federal funds involved in any of the customers that we deal with. And then what we've really focused on the last couple of years is, again, conduct an open and transparent and inclusive process. We have many groups that on this rate process. We have one large group that meets on a quarterly basis, and we've broken down into subcommittees that review rates or review different areas, issues. If there are certain concerns on certain rates, we these groups address that with us. So we try to make this a real transparent process here by including all our, as many of our customers as we can. And now this is the next slide here you'll see is a process we go through for rate setting. One of the key part of good, accurate rate setting is to get a volume, your volume forecast as accurate as can be. We need to know how many units of the product or service we are going to be providing, and that's something that we've, again, instituted a new process in the last year, 2 years of doing this online. We send a survey out to all our customers with information asking them what do they see their volume and all the different rates that the services that we provide them. Do they see something new coming on the horizon? Are they going to cut back? We try to get all that information. We try to get as much information as we can, again, in the forecast for that. And kind of parallel with that process is and goes on afterwards is the budgeting within OET itself. We have to look at all the costs that we incur to provide these services, anywhere from staffing to equipment purchases, supplies, space, all those type of things. We have to look at what it's going to cost to provide these services. Then we do what we call our internal allocation process. That's taking all these costs that we have and then distributing those to the different product lines. First, we have a product line like application hosting will be a product line, or WAN services, wide area network services. It's a group of a bunch of products that we sell, and we budget at that level first. We try to get all the costs within that we have in there into those different categories. And those costs include direct costs, which are a cost of service within our cost structure here. If it's, let's just say, application hosting, they have to buy a CPU. Those costs, equipment costs, depreciation, those costs go directly to that product line. Then we have what we call shared costs. A good example of that would be a software product that we can use through different areas within the agency. So we split that software cost to those areas that are benefiting from that software. Then the final one is our administrative charges, which are our costs that cover the whole agency, things like our space, our supplies, our attorney general costs, financial management. It's services or costs that benefit the whole agency. So we take all those costs again, and then we get at the product line. Then from that product line, we have to bring that down to a product code, and that the product code is the actual services or products that we provide to the customer. So if a customer wants a service, they look at these different product codes and determine what is needed there, and that's what we bill on, is that product code line there. Now, throughout that process, then we go through this rate-setting process, again, with the customer input on a regular basis through that. But we have to do what's called a rate matrix. We take all these costs associated with each of the product lines that we have, and we have to go within the MAPS accounting system here, state's accounting system, and break it out by all the different object codes and just detail all the different costs that are associated with this product line. Then you basically take the volume forecasting and you divide the cost by the volume and you get a per unit rate on that. And again, we're all through this process. We're checking this with agencies and we're trying to reduce costs and look at other things there. We again try to reevaluate the forecasting there. And then the final, we produce a final rate package, and our rate package is a book. It's a very large document. We have many, many rates. So we have to put this into a very large document. But there's a lot of things that the Department of Management and Budget, they require us to put things like our forecasting information, our individual budgets, things like cash flow analysis, a lot of different things that go into the rate package. It's almost like a business plan that we provide every year. And then finally, that package, once it's completed and reviewed internally and with our customers, we provide that to the Department of Management and Budget, and they have final approval over our rates. And all along in this process with customers, they're included in all those meetings with us too. So they're part of this whole process here. But they have the final review and approval of our rates.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'm struck by this complicated formula because the other day when we were asking about the cars that are in the Department of Admin, they just said, well, it's cheaper to send them outside and have them fixed outside of the state because of wages and other concerns. So I don't think they went through a process like this to determine that. So I'm just kind of struck by, you know, this is a very, looks like a very complicated process. Bottom line, I guess, is would it be cheaper for the state to contract out a lot of these services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, they actually do go through the same process we do. Theirs is a much smaller process because they're looking at a car, what's associated with a car, you know, the actual car, the repairs, the gas. We're looking at all of IT, a big chunk of IT, wide area networks, computers, mainframes, all these different things. So it's really the same process, and they have to provide the same rate matrix or business plan to the Department of Management and Budget as OET does. Now, as far as is it cheaper to go outside, we don't think so. We go through this analysis, so that's part of the comparison we have to do. We have to provide these our customers' needs, and we try to provide more than what you would typically or maybe expect from the outside here. Some of the we have internal knowledge of these things more than an outside vendor would. We have different security requirements. There's a lot of things that we try to put in that are built into these rates that you don't always get in the outside.
Senator Olsen, if I may, we also do outsource quite a bit of activity because of this process that we've gone through. For example, the state does not own its telecommunications networks, the wide area networks that serve schools and counties and state agencies. We lease capacity from the private sector because experience has shown that's cheaper than building all of those networks, a redundant set of networks paralleling what the private sector already provides. Similarly, application development. It's more expensive for us to keep people with state-of-the-art development skills on staff when we don't have development projects. than it is to go out and contract for those services when we have an application that needs to be built or developed or implemented. And that the combination of those is a significant amount of money. And we do that because that is the most cost-efficient way to get quality services. For many of the other things that we're talking about, which are supporting day-to-day services and the applications that enable our agencies to do their programs, it's simply cheaper and more efficient for us to do it.
Okay, Mr. Freund, go ahead.
Great. And if we continue on here, talk a little bit about the revenue generated by our rates. One of the really key things here to look at is we have over 4,000 different rates. There's over 4,000 different things that our customers can purchase from us. Now, just to give you a few examples here, we have application hosting and central processing. It's the, you maybe hear the term CPU or CICS. That generates $25.2 million in revenue for our agency. There's all the network telecommunications services. That provides $17.4 million. And then data storage and backup and management, that's $9.6 million. Now, that's just an example of a few of the really large ones. If we go to the next slide, here's some our main revenue generators here. These are the first slide will be the top five customers that we have here. You'll see DHS, DPS, Deed, Revenue, and DOT are our main customers by size of revenue generated. And those are different. Your main thing with DHS and DPS is your CPU usage, and there's network in there. Deed is with more database services. So each agency has a different areas that are key focus, but this is the revenue that's generated from the top five.
And Mr. Chairman and members, if you look at the table, you'll see considerable fluctuation from year to year, up and down in the different agencies, and that reflects one of the problems that we have in predicting these. Changes in the economy, changes in business, changes in demand for program, changes in the law will drive different levels of activity for these major systems. I was for several years Chief Information Officer for the Department of Human Services, which is the biggest customer of OET. You see changes there from the state's economic assistance and health care systems. The charges that money we receive from DHS fluctuates up and down by a significant margin every year because of changes in program requirements, changes in the number of people they serve because of situations in the economy and so on. And it makes predicting very hard for them and for us. You'll see other changes in there, for example, with the Department of Revenue. You'll see a big jump in fiscal year 2007. And the reason is for that jump is not, as you might expect, the integrated revenue system, although that's a component of it. But Revenue at that point decided to outsource the management of their data centers and their internal operations to OET. So they now pay us a rate to manage their data centers and their servers and routers and storage and everything. They don't pay that money to themselves, essentially. That is a savings to that agency that they can use to concentrate on their agency's business. And you will see other changes that reflect changes in technology, changes in our costs, mainframe costs versus server costs, and so on. So the fluctuation every year, agency to agency, can be very dramatic.
If we go on to the next, chart, this one shows you the rates of the top five small boards and councils, and so we're just kind of giving you an example of the revenue that's generated here. But you'll notice those are the top five, and then the next screen goes on to the non-agency accounts that we have, MinSCU, the U of M, counties, and cities. So we even provide services to those areas.
Mr. Chair?
It just seems that maybe Senator Pappas might have an interest in this, but it would seem that within the MinSCU and U of M system, they should have people in-house that might be able to do some stuff, and they're going to OET to get their technology taken care of.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, in the case of MinSCU, they do have a very good IT operation. Most of the costs for MinSCU are network costs because we contract on behalf of all the state entities for that network capacity, and they benefit from that aggregation of demand and use our bandwidth costs as part of their service. It's simply a pass-through for them.
Sir, we'll see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. when I see counties and cities down there, one of the biggest issues, I think, in rural Minnesota has been 800 megahertz and the cost of putting that together. Is it possible that if there's an opportunity for some federal, from the federal stimulus, I know they're talking possibly about, you know, technology that might be like the 800 megahertz system. Would that something that your department could maybe be the backbone for the state for and then back charge the counties for that service?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, I'm far from an expert on this, but I believe all the 800 megahertz systems are coordinated by the Department of Public Safety. Now, their backbone system uses much of our capacity, but they have special needs, and it goes beyond the, without getting into the topology of the network, goes beyond the endpoint where we deliver service to how you distribute service after that. So that's a question you'd probably want to direct to the Department of Public Safety. That's not our area of expertise.
Okay, thanks.
Ms. Freund?
Okay. Next, we can go on to some cost containment areas here. I want to go over that. In this past, this current year, fiscal year 2009, what we proposed in our rates and what we're doing right now this fiscal year is overall rate reduction of 0.23%. Which equates to about $1.2 million. So what we try every year to, you know, cut back on our rates, reduce our rates and things. But now if you look, this is an aggregate of all those 4,000 rates. So some rates have gone up, some rates have down, but gone down. But when you aggregate all that, it's a 0.23 reduction and a $1.2 million savings to all of the customers for that year. So if they've used, it's based on the using the same volume as the previous year with the new rates. Now, and also now in FY09, we had an increase, a net increase of only one FTE in our agency. And some of the cost reductions achieved are through enhancements to vendor management and contract negotiations. And what we try to do is get enterprise contracts and services here. So rather than every agency going out and doing this, you aggregate that demand and do one contract, and there's a lot of savings over there. And we just look at trying to really be looking at all the different negotiations that we do with all the different contracts. We leverage enterprise procurement. We've done a lot of work in that over the last year or two, and again, trying to aggregate all demand and get a better price for these. We develop a contract or specifications or standards, and it saves price, saves cost, and price is lower for all agencies to purchase those items. Competitive pricing and new service providers. We're always looking at different ways to provide the best service we can, and looking at who is the best to provide a service. OET does not have to provide all the IT services. If there's a better provider, we want to work with that and just provide the customers with the best service. We have internal operating process improvements and technical enhancements. Every year there's new things coming out in technology. We have to try to implement changes and keep going with that and provide the agencies with what they need to run their business.
I do have a question. As I said, Mr. Freund, I did have this table handed out, and I realize that this is not a full or comprehensive one, but this, I believe these are the rates that have been approved by Minnesota Management Budget for OET, and virtually, as I look through the list, it looks like most of the rates have actually gone up. So where have rates actually been reduced for the services that you're going to be providing for the next fiscal year, from 08 to 09?
We're currently in 09. There's actually pages of in our rate package that list a lot of those, but some of the big areas were CPU. Again, the CPU, which is our biggest product line there, the rate went down on that. I don't have all that specifically, but I can definitely send you copies of the within our business plan or rate package, we list a section that shows all the ones that changed from year to year and whether they went up or down, and then any new charges or services we provided. But there are an awful lot of them. But yeah, and some go up, some go down. It's all different. And there's some rates that are, we have a rate for instance, for a CPU, it might be like 0.05. If you move that a little bit, the percentage is quite a bit. If you have a rate that's $500 and it goes to $505, that's on percentages. So there's a big difference in how that's calculated, but we aggregate that together. So the overall, when you put all those together, that's how we came up with that 0.23 reduction overall. But I will get you that information.
Yeah, well, I'm interested in obviously I'm not able to go through line by line and figure everything out, but I'm trying to be sensitive to these other budget areas within the legislature, because if budgets are being cut, let's say within the executive branch by, say, 10%, but you're raising your rates in some areas, well, that adds to some of the complications of some of these agencies trying to figure out what to do, because your prices are going up and they still have to make other cuts elsewhere if they're so. I think we do have an interest in what's going on with the interagency charges that are going on here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will provide you with that information. And one of the things to take into consideration here, these rates were developed and approved some time ago. We are now going to be in a process of this upcoming year, and that's something we'll really have to take into consideration working with the agencies, is what services they can provide, what level of service can we provide, and try to keep our rates as low as possible. And one of the key things we got to look at, too, is if we aggregate, the more we can aggregate the demand of these agencies, that they're not out there doing it all on their own, each individual agency doing this, that enables us to try to reduce the cost, overall cost of that, or the rate for that per customer. So those are the kind of things that we're going to be looking at right now to develop our plan for the fiscal year 10.
Okay.
And if we move on to the next chart here, you can see that this shows kind of a trend over time here, that how our rates have gone over the years. Now, there's many different factors that go into each reduction or increase, but you can see the majority of the years we've had reductions in overall rates, so we try to work on that as best we can. But each year, there's many, many factors that determine why the rates have gone up or down. But in this past year, it was mainly the CPU units and storage areas that we gained those efficiencies. And if you go on to the next one, here's a good example of how aggregating demand can really help out. This shows you, the first one here is the application hosting. It's a CPU, central processing unit, and that's for processing batch jobs on our mainframes. If you look at the top chart there, you'll see that over time here, that shows the unit cost, the rate we charge for that service, and you can see from the fiscal year 2000 to 2009, just a steady decline in the rates charged year to year. And if you look right below that, you'll look at the same time frame here, but that's the volume. So you look at the volume of these services, and they continue to do a big increase over time. So as the volume increases on these, we're able to lower our rate, per unit rate on that. So this just gives you a good example of how that's working. And now it's different with every service we provide here, but this is a real good example. And we have another example on the next page that shows our CS and Supra. That's our mainframes, but more of the online processing part of it. Again, you see the steep decline in the per unit rate and the increase in the volume over time.
Yeah, this is just about the Sarah Sina question. This is just about the end of your presentation.
Yes.
Right? Okay. I've got a couple of questions here too. You're talking about setting rates and charging for the services that you provide for technology for the other agencies. How much control do you have, though, in decisions on the other agencies make on the overall spending that they have? For instance, if one agency decides that they want to have a turn over all their laptops every 3 years as opposed to 5 years or 8 years or whatever, is that something that you control, or is that something the other agencies control, or what's the interaction between OET and those kinds of decisions that are made by the other agencies?
Mr. Chairman, we don't control it as much as monitor it. There are standards in place from agency to agency that they have to follow, and it tends to reflect the nature of the business that they have. There are some agencies, for example, where their field people are on the road constantly with laptops, and frankly, they wear out in 18 to 30 months. Other agencies, a laptop might last 36 to 48 months. It depends on the usage and the nature of the work they're doing with those. So we don't try to tell them what they should do, but we do try to keep track of the trends they have in replacement. And through the consolidation and the standardization process, we try to keep the costs down so that there are a few standard configurations that most of the machines will fit, which reduces the maintenance costs and the replacement costs for those sorts of machines. That's more the nature of our oversight function rather than our financial function.
So what do you do or can you do if you, say, sense an agency is, you know, buying more computers than they need or having more turnover in computers than they ought to be having? I mean, if you can't tell them what to do, what do you do?
Mr. Chairman, I think, and members, I think it's more a matter of having a dialogue with them at that point when you've identified that you're seeing trends that might be disturbing in their costs, in their usage. We can talk to them and try to find out what's going on, try to understand the business need that's going on there. It hasn't, frankly, been a significant problem in state agencies that we've ever discovered. You do find different standards, but when you go into it, there are usually reasons why those standards are different, and we try to respect that. They know their business better than we do. We're just trying to identify when the cost of replacement exceeds the cost of maintenance on those machines, and it typically, and probably not surprisingly, tends to correspond pretty much to when their warranty runs out. Because as soon as they have repairs that aren't covered by warranty, then their cost of inventorying and repairing and maintaining those machines skyrockets. And it is that human cost and the parts cost, not the replacement cost, that really drives the life cycle on computer acquisitions.
What do you do then on issues of software? Because you may have one agency going in one direction with software and another agency a different one, and they may be incompatible when it comes down to sharing data or other things. I mean, who oversees that to make sure that we're spending the right amount of money in the right direction?
State, Mr. Chairman and members, the state has an architectural process, one aspect of which is the technological architecture, which looks at what are the standards that the state has in place. We make recommendations on what we think the best package should be for simply that reason of interoperability and of systems and interchange of information. But the fact is most of the major commercial products do share information with one another as it stands. Where you run into problems are with either very specialized applications, CAD, computer-assisted design programs, for example. They're often incompatible with one another. But the needs for somebody doing architectural design and somebody else that's doing civil engineering, for example, are significantly different. And we respect that, again, because the needs of their agencies are different. We have not gotten to the point of mandating thou shalt only use Microsoft Office or OpenOffice or WordPerfect or whatever other software package there is, simply because in many agencies they have production applications that are tied to using those desktop applications. But we found that in most cases the state's purchasing power is enough to keep those costs reasonably competitive. We have looked at and do support open standards in software, so you'll find a lot of open standards or open source software in use in state government. But by and large, the decision on what package you use is a business decision that you make when you look at the capabilities you have to support your business and what products will support those.
It's tough enough trying to get the state computers aligned with each other so they can talk to each other. This does get into the services that you charge for and so forth, but of course we want to make sure that what we're doing on the state level is also going to be compatible with what's happening at the local level, our cities, our townships, our counties, and also what's happening at the federal level. And obviously those are well beyond our control, but what are we doing to make sure that the computer systems are all going to be able to talk to each other to the best of our ability?
Mr. Chairman, talk to each other can mean a lot of different things, and that's part of the complexity with this. There are basically protocols that they can follow for exchange of information electronically that can transcend some of those boundaries, and the use of standards like XML help make that easier. There are both proprietary standards in common use and open source standards, or open standards like PDF is now an open standard, I believe, and JPEG is an open standard. .doc, which has been for years the word processing standard. 95% of the market out there either understands or can understand and can write in the document format other people can use. And it becomes, for us, an exercise in frustration trying to decide where's the economic trade-off of buying one product and forcing everybody to change versus having requirements that the as currently in statute, that they can make their output available in different formats to make sure there's no proprietary boundary that users can't cross. So an agency producing a report, for example, in Microsoft Word, which is one of the, obviously, the major market standards out there, can also be produced in PDF, which is available for anybody to read, or as a text file. As I think some of you are aware, we had a lengthy discussion last year with other states on open standards. And the basic problem we face is the closer you get to a universal standard, the less features you have. And that means that many of the things that make documents valuable by the inclusion of graphics or the inclusion of features that enable you to communicate information better, you start to strip those out the closer you get to the most basic or lowest common denominator format. So we're trying to have discussions with agencies. There is within the law now sufficient requirement for agencies to make reports and communications available in the format that will work with their customers within reason. And that's all we can do at this point is try to monitor compliance with those requirements.
Cheryl, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Probably similar along the lines you were going. The last 2 years, we've heard in this committee about the legacy systems, like at MAPS, and there's no capital money to replace a 1968 computer. But as I'm reading this here, where you kind of put in a system and then bill it back, is there a possibility to finance some of these bigger legacy systems where your office would purchase them and then the revenue or somebody would pay you back for that?
Actually, that's a nice segue to one of our later sections when we talk about the use of creative financing. It is conceivable, but remember, we have to pay for it up front somehow. And that's where we get into the idea of using revenue bonds and other methods of trying to fund development. But yes, there are always alternatives. They never are free alternatives. So.
Cheryl Sain?
On DPS, we were able to find a way to finance that legacy system, but I don't suspect we can ask people to pay a surcharge on paying their income taxes or something like that. So the other departments don't have the avenue that the DPS did. So I would be interested in the next when you
try to
that
address
segue.
That in the next section, Senator Olsen.
Even though, as you indicated early on, Mr. Lally, we don't spend a lot of general fund money on the OET, and a lot of what you do is paid for by these fees that you charge, somebody may at some point say, well, look, we're doing all these services for these government agencies. We charge for them. Maybe the state should just get out of that and just hand it over to some private vendor and have them take care of all that and let them, we don't have to pay for them, let them charge the services and so forth. That's a huge issue and a big discussion matter, but is it something that we ought to at least be keeping in the back of our minds?
Mr. Chairman and members, certainly it's a business strategy and it's a legitimate business strategy. The considerations that you need to keep in mind is what are you outsourcing and how much is it going to cost, not in terms of the initial cost, but in the total cost of ownership. What is typically the case if you look into what has happened in a number of other jurisdictions that have outsourced their entire operation, lock, stock, and barrel. Typically, there's an entry cost that's quite low, and it's very appealing because, hey, we're saving money this year. 2 to 3 years down the road, as the cost profile changes and all of a sudden your costs are going much, much higher, because they front-loaded the savings and back-loaded the costs, but you're still obligated to keep that operation going. There are also significant issues, and you can see that in Texas, in San Diego County, in Orange County. You can see it in several places. I think Connecticut outsourced a major portion of their computer operation to the private sector, and there are quality issues, there are transition issues. And the reality is, because state government has so many of these legacy applications, which are old languages, old databases that are kept in operation because, A, they work, and, B, they're cheap, when you get into supporting those applications, when you start to have a lot of quality issues. So, yes, it's a legitimate strategy. That's what caused us to outsource things like a lot of the development activity and the networking. But it's not a panacea, and contrary to what you will hear from some of the people who make their living that way, it's not always the best business decision when you look at the total cost of ownership and the satisfaction. But by all means, look at it.
Any other questions about the fee part of the presentation? If not, thank you, Mr. Freund. I guess we have Mr. Boozy next.
Chairman, yes. Chris Boozy is our Chief Information Security Officer for the state, a figure who I think is familiar to many of you.
Welcome back to the Budget Division, Mr. Boozy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Christopher Boozy, and I am the state's Chief Information Security Officer. What I'm going to present today, in the past when I've been before this commission, when I was recently hired as the state's first Chief Information Security Officer, and starting up the new enterprise security program, I spent a lot of time talking about the types of threats that all government agencies face on a daily basis. Today, I'm not going to go down that road again and talk about what kind of computer security threats that we have. What I wanted to do today is I wanted to focus on the fact that through legislative action, we have created an enterprise security program. We've provided some funding for that program. And what I want to do today is tell you what we've actually done and try and give you a sense of the value proposition of your investment in our statewide enterprise security strategy. So starting back at July 2006, when I was first hired, when we began the enterprise security program, we really had a model that was completely decentralized. Every agency, when it came to managing information security risks, acted completely independently. The staff and the state agencies did their best with the limited resources that they had at their disposal. But the fact of the matter was is that the problems that they faced were simply too complicated and too costly to solve on an agency-by-agency basis. The evidence that you saw as a legislative body was in the numerous legislative audit reports on almost all agencies that came out, had the same problems in every single report. I wrote a lot of those reports back when I worked for the Legislative Auditor's Office. Today, I think we have a success story with the Enterprise Security Program, and I'm proud of some of the accomplishments that we've made in the 2.5 years since we've been going. The Office of Enterprise Technology, and I have to give Gopal a lot of credit for this, for really helping push our program, provides enterprise-wide leadership services. So we're working on behalf of all the state agencies. And I think one of the most important things that we've done as an organization is we've created a body that's called the Statewide Information Security Council. What this body is it's the security leaders from all the state agencies, and it helps us form the strategy that we're going to put in place for the Enterprise Security Program and decide what we actually need to do. But one thing that you may not be aware of is that the Statewide Information Security Council also includes members of the legislative agencies from the House and the Senate, and it also includes representatives from cities and counties as well. So the body that we put together to help us govern the security program includes all branches of government and levels of government as well. So I think it's a very successful model to help us decide what we're going to do in the program. We also are one of the few states in the nation that have actually put together an enterprise-wide security strategic plan. And that's an effort that we spent about a year on. There was a core team of about 20 government entities that helped us put that together. But if you go out on OET's website today, what we have published is we have a 5-year roadmap to go from where we are today to where we think we ultimately need to be. The plan includes 19 high-level strategies that we think we need to achieve in 5 years, grouped into three broad categories. Proactive security monitoring, improving our situational awareness, and robust crisis and incident response. So you can go out to the website, and you can actually read the strategic plan. We have a foundation that's now set for our security program. We examined a lot of different options, and we are basing our program based on a model that's successfully deployed in a lot of branches a lot of agencies in the federal government. And finally, one thing that I think is really noteworthy is we've gone beyond just policy and the high-level guidance. We also are building and deploying shared security solutions on several different fronts, and we'll talk about some of those. So it's not just laying out the policy foundation. There's real solutions that are being crafted and deployed that are now being used by all government entities. So looking at some of the security solutions and some of the things that we've put in place, we're really doing a lot of things on the technical front, as you'd expect from a technology agency. But I think it's also important to recognize that we're doing a lot of things on the non-technical side as well. So, for example, we're putting together an enterprise security program framework. And what that is, what we're trying to do there is we're trying to set the bar and define a plan for success through defined policies and standards that every government entity needs to follow. So that's one of the core things that we're putting out there, is we're defining where the bar needs to be set. We've also done quite a few efforts now to improve the competency of the staff in the government agencies through training programs. We've done quite a few different things with product-specific training, but I think one of the most important things we've done is we've done broader security training. And one of the goals that we're having is to increase the number of certified security professionals in state government to improve the competency. And I'm proud that in the 2 years that we've been marching down this path, we've added over 30 new certified security professionals in the state agencies. We've also helped some counties in that effort as well, and higher ed with MNSCU, who's a partner in a lot of the different efforts that we're involved with today. As you know, from some of the efforts that we've helped the legislature, we do not have a large staff in this area. We have actually 2 FTE that are devoted to direct assistance, but we are helping government agencies through direct security consulting help as much as we possibly can, whether it's in the case of the legislature, helping you understand how to deploy wireless technology securely, or one of the major efforts that we're involved with right now is after some of the publicity that was in the news about some of the security breaches at the Department of Veterans Affairs, we've spent hundreds of hours out in the field trying to directly help that agency understand its security gaps and put in place a plan to fix those gaps. So that direct consulting consistence is just invaluable to those agencies that can't afford to hire the talented security professionals on their own. Looking over in the technical column of some of the return on investment for the security program, I think one of the most powerful examples that we have is our vulnerability and threat management program. When you read about the security problems that we face in the news today, one of the things that's clear to me as the state's CISO is that a lot of those things happen because exploitable vulnerabilities in the computer systems that we run are not found and fixed before nefarious people actually find those things first and exploit them for ill purposes. One of the things that we've done to address this issue is put in place an enterprise-wide vulnerability and threat management program. It includes a team of people in the Office of Enterprise Technology, plus some of the very best tools on the markets to continuously assess all of the technology across the entire state government, plus we're partnering with higher ed to assess the higher ed environment as well. Collectively, when this system is fully deployed, we'll be doing ongoing assessments that we estimate of 150,000 government computers. We're also having conversations with counties and cities and other levels of government as well, because taxpayer money has been used to finance and build this system. There's no reason why long-term as a strategy we can't have counties and cities participate and take advantage of this too. Obviously, when we get to that point, we'll have to have them help us with the incremental cost because we're not funded to do that. But I think this has been a very successful program. So to date, we've had well over 100,000 scans that have been done of government computer systems used to find problems with systems and to remediate those problems before they're exploited by hackers. This month, we're also rolling out another type of external scanning, and we're going to be providing kind of the Chinese hacker mentality assessment of all of government, not just the executive branch of state government, but basically every single customer of OET who uses our wide area network. Starting in July, we will be doing ongoing scans of everybody who's part of the state's wide area network. That includes state agencies, higher education institutions, counties, cities, public libraries. If you're a customer of OET, the fact that we've invested in this kind of technology, this is part of the deal. Every month, we will be assessing your systems from the external point of view, and if there's problems, we're going to be contacting those organizations to help them fix the problems. We also do quite a bit of work on security incident response and computer forensics. The goal there is we have multiple security incidents that happen per day, and our goal there is to have one standardized process across state government where we can actually help agencies that have problems prevent the damage from spreading to other government agencies and other systems, and to help them understand what happens so we can prevent future damage prevent future damage from occurring as well. For those of you that came to the enterprise security briefing for government executives to really explain this, we walked through a website defacement and what happens with the website defacement, not only from the embarrassment and the publicity standpoint, but once it's known in the hacker circles that you have a problem in your environment, those type of the bad characters kind of swarm in, and we showed with forensic data how many different government organization, how many different hacker groups actually come into a system and take control of a system once one bad event happens and it becomes public. And then finally, the last example that I wanted to point out today deals with continuity of operations planning. The last time I testified, it was right before the legislative auditors put out a report talking about the grave circumstances we had with COOP planning across state government. But one of the things that we have done is we've put in place a very good policy and standard to drive where we go with the continuity of operations effort. And we're also now looking at real solutions with the goal of achieving compliance by July of 2011, where mission-critical government computer systems have a continuity of operations strategy, and that strategy is, in fact, a testable strategy, something that we actually practice the testing on. The first stages that we're working on now, we are just completing a government-wide assessment where we're looking at all services provided by all government agencies, and we're trying to rank the services and look at potential ways to recover those type of services enterprise-wide rather than looking at this on an agency-by-agency basis.
Go ahead. Yeah, and then I'll get to you, Senator Olstein.
Okay. I have a question.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm very tied into this DPS computer system. So I remember a couple years ago you said you stay up late all night worrying about these people hacking these systems. Is this new system going to be, state of the art, impossible to hack into, and protect people's driver's license numbers and all those things that system is designed for?
I don't think anything is impossible, but Mr. Boozy?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the answer to that is if there was a way to build systems that weren't hackable, then there would be no need to have an enterprise security program. And I think we're going to be here for the long haul because no matter how hard we try to build systems with robust controls in there, there's also a counterculture that's working to figure out the pinholes in the systems that can be exploited to break those systems. So it very much is a cat and mouse game that I think we're going to always be playing.
Okay, go ahead.
To refresh your memory on the money side of the enterprise security program, this last biennium, we had a special, I guess I would call it a startup appropriation from the legislature to get our program up and running. As you've heard from some of the prior testimony, the types of solutions that need to be put in place are very expensive. They require people. They require some heavy investments in technology. We're hoping we're doing that well by building systems that are built once and shared by all. But in fiscal year 08 and 09, our startup appropriation is roughly about $5.8 million per year. Looking at fiscal year 10 and beyond, we have an ongoing base appropriation of $4.2 million. That funding goes to pay for the salaries of the 21 staff that are funded by the general fund appropriation, as well as the Enterprise Security Program tool costs. So to give you an example of that, when we look at the people and the processes that are in the cost, the total cost of ownership for the Enterprise Vulnerability and Threat Management Program that's used by the entire government, that one solution costs the state government about $1.2 million per year to run that solution. But when you look at that, for the enterprise as a whole, every government entity gets the value of that tool. It's something that we can expand out at relatively minimal cost to other branches of government as well. And it provides agencies with the ability to assess their technology up to three times per day, if that's what, really what they're looking to do, rather than having somebody come in and possibly scan your environment one time per quarter. So we think it's a very cost-effective type of solution, just to give you an example of the value proposition on that.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Rowling.
I just wanted to ask about, you mentioned that you could probably do more and keep the costs low. You know, there's a proposal that is floating around the legislature now about cluster buying for school districts, so, you know, that we'd have like state contracts. And one of the things that struck me is that I do think that there's savings to be had in the computer area, because you can buy from national distributors, and the bigger the purchase, the better deal they might give you. But what about this when we're talking about security systems? And I don't know if all the school systems have something in place now or what they're operating with, but do you have some of the school districts currently in your program, and what would be the opportunity to expand to include all the school districts in the state if that was something that would move forward?
Mr. Bozzi.
Mr. Chair, committee members, in the enterprise security solutions that we're developing today, I really don't see any reason why we couldn't have the solutions spread out to other levels of government as well, whether it's a city, whether it's a school district. I don't see reasons why we couldn't do that. But there is a difference between joint purchases, where we all get together and decide we're going to, you know, buy some of the same stuff, and shared solutions. And I think there's certainly savings to be had in joint purchasing type of arrangements. But I think where there's real savings in government is where we start putting our heads together and deciding to do something once and share that one infrastructure. So we could have said that every government agency, we think it's a good deal if you all use our, if we all decide to use this one particular tool for vulnerability and threat management. But we would have had every government organization out there building the hardware and the software infrastructure, when the fact of the matter is we really only need to build it once and to share that solution. And it's the people that manage this stuff long-term where the big dollars get involved. So I agree that there's opportunities to be had on the purchasing side, but there's also opportunities to be had on sharing and simplifying.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, also, if I may, I don't know the nature of the clustering concept, but might want to have a discussion with our information standards and resource management function, which develops contracts for procurement of hardware and software that are very, very competitive, much better than like the federal GIS program and other things. And those are already available to local jurisdictions to use. So I would suggest that they might want to explore that as an opportunity as well.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Olwin.
is there a fee if they join your program? Do you charge a fee? I know Dana Badgerow was in the other day, and she said that the fee for the joint purchasing, I believe, had been $400 per unit of government, but that local unit of government, but that they had dropped that. And I'm just wondering about yours.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, there is a fee. It's administered by the Department of Administration. It's a very small fee on each transaction and covers the cost of doing the negotiations and the presentation of these aggregated demand contracts with the vendors. But it's we can get more information to you if you're interested in that. But it has saved colleges and local jurisdictions millions of dollars literally over the last few years because these are extraordinarily highly competitive contracts.
Now, along the line of fees, though, some state agency contacts OET and says, you know, we believe we have some security problems, you know, we want you to come on in and help us resolve them. The agency pays OET for that service in reviewing, upgrading, whatever their security, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, committee members, we get multiple instances per day where we have that various scenario take place.
Right.
And we have two full-time forensic investigators that we pay for with our general fund security appropriation, and their job is to go out and help organizations figure out what happened, what needs to be done, how do we cleanse the problems in those computer systems, and they are not charged a fee for that work. Now, oftentimes what we find is there may be recommendations about the way that they use technology that we may make recommendations that they have to use a technology differently, or potentially we may even make a recommendation that the way they're able to operate isn't cost-effective for them to do it safely, and we may recommend that they move some of their equipment into OET where there is a fee, but the investigation and that work itself is not a fee for service. That's something that's paid for with the security enterprise appropriation.
So as far as state security goes for computers, the money that is appropriated is pretty much it as far as what you can and cannot do? You don't get any other sources?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the general way to say that is the enterprise security appropriation is the money that we use to fund the solutions within government. With that said, one caveat is some of the products that OET delivers, for example, mainframe computer services, we have some people that actually report to me as a state CISO that support those products, but that's just a cost of the product. It's built into the rates, so there's not revenue that particularly comes in for that service, but it's part of the product itself. But in general, the enterprise security appropriation is what's used to deliver the services.
Okay, and you know, we 2 years ago we had a much higher number, and we all ultimately settled at a lower number. And I know we're still a little ways away from getting the governor's proposals, but do you have any sense as to whether or not the amount that we spent for security is doing the job that we wanted to do? Or I'm sure the case could be made. You could spend 100 times more, we'd still be vulnerable. But how are we doing as far as the appropriation we had for giving assurance that we have computer security, like somebody's not going to hack into the revenue tax returns?
Mr. Chair, committee members, when we put forth the plan for the enterprise security program and looked for initial funding, I felt like we were pretty conservative when we put together the numbers. And at that time, we felt that to really put in place everything that needed to happen for the government as a whole, that the enterprise security program would probably have to be funded at an area that exceeded $10 million per year. I believe the number that we put on the table was about $10.8 million per year. Right now, we're running at $4.2 million per year. So the missing slide from the deck that we really didn't want to get into today is what are the things that are not being done that we need to do better at? But the bottom line here is that whatever level we're going to be funded at, we're going to work together collectively as a government to try and do things once the best that we can and try and hit the highest risk areas possible. So that's the game plan that we have on the table today. If we had more money, we certainly could do a lot more, and I think we could demonstrate with a bigger number that we could do a lot more things wisely. But the economy and the fiscal situation is what it is, and we're going to do the best with what we have. If it comes down to $100 left on the table, I'm going to try and deliver the $100 the best way that I can do it.
Okay. Any questions about security? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Boosie. Mr. Lally?
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that in discussions with you and staff, you were asking us also to give a high-level overview on two other areas in our domain right now, and those were financing and email, the enterprise email project. So I'll go over those briefly. If we want more detail, we can find it, and then if you have any other questions, certainly we'll be happy to entertain them. A little over a year ago, we drafted a report with the cooperation of the department, then Department of Finance, and with the collaboration of a number of other states, looking at alternative methods of financing IT within government. And we looked at both the traditional methods that have been used widely as well as somewhat more creative and esoteric methods as possible. And our report was published and has received some favorable response nationwide. And what we were trying to do was to find ways that we could go beyond funding dramatic new systems to how do we find better ways of funding the totality of IT, because not all information technology is new application development. A lot of it is simply maintenance and operation or extension and modification of systems that were out there. We noted that some of the ways that we can extend the financing impact of the revenues we have are around the use of shared systems, where we share the cost across multiple entities and the benefits, thereby reducing the individual development costs. So there. And then when it comes to legacy systems, as the question came earlier, that becomes of particular importance because often there's not a strong constituency for replacing a legacy system. In most cases, computer systems don't just die. They go into kind of a state of cyber entropy where they just wind down and they become less and less useful. Their performance decreases, their cost increases, but yet they continue to deliver some value. And it's hard to make a case in straitened economic times that we should invest $10, $20, $100 million in a new system that essentially does much of what it does now, only does it more reliably or more quickly or more cheaply. Because it's a hard business case to make in many cases. We also have to find a way to start modifying the state's approach to doing business with our citizens and with the businesses that we work with in an electronic world. The old bricks and mortar approach of where we tell our citizens, well, I'm sorry, I know it's 7:30 in the morning and you just got off work, but we don't open our office till 8 o'clock, and then you have to come down to our offices if it's not a holiday, and come see us, and if we can get our work done by 4:30, that's fine. If not, you'll have to come back the next day. Well, clearly that's not acceptable in this day and age. People are used to Amazon.com, and they're used to doing business over the Internet. But there's more to having a solid electronic government environment than simply slapping a web front end on processes that are rooted in World War II practices. So we've got to find a way to modify the business processes, a critical function, and support them with new technologies that will enable us to do both in the traditional and new ways of doing business a better job of serving our customers. And we have to deal, as Chris has testified many times in the past and again today, to have a secure operations environment. You can't have a truly secure system that serves people. It's like the old saying, two people can keep a secret if one of them is dead. Well, if you want a system that's totally secure, you can't let anybody use it. So therefore, it's a matter of managing the risk and putting the architecture and the infrastructure and the tools in place so that the risks are manageable and detectable. So trying to come up with these shared system approaches that give us the greatest leverage, extend what we have in place and have already paid for, and still come up with the new changes that people expect is a real challenge in an environment like this, where the economy is in dire straits and there isn't just a lot of new money available. The traditional approaches that we've seen in Minnesota have been limited, and they're usually either a rate-based program, and for all of the advantages of a rate-based program, it doesn't let you do investments up front because you can't spend future revenues. You have to have the money in hand now to buy new technologies. The other alternative is going through the appropriation process, which is a highly competitive process, of course, and can't always have enough money available to do all the things that need to be done. So that led us to come up with a litany alternative funding opportunities that the state could explore. It doesn't mean they're all good ideas in a given situation, but they might be an answer or part of the answer in an individual situation. And very briefly, one of those is the traditional appropriation process with which you are very familiar. The fee-based process, which is our 970 fund or our revolving fund that Larry talked about a few moments ago. Internal funding, which is to call upon agencies to salvage money through layoffs and other economies to fund their own changes. But there are some practical limitations when the cost of a new system exceeds an agency's budget. You can't say, don't do any work for a couple of years while we find out how to fund a new system. The investment fund approach, where money is put into a fund and it can be loaned out to agencies to or groups of agencies to develop applications or shared applications, but again, it requires some upfront funding. And then protection of that funding down the road so you have some stability. Another alternative that is increasingly common is a vendor participation approach where there's a shared risk and a shared benefit. Now, this might be the kind of situation where you have an agency that will say, I have a business operation, it's going to produce revenue in the nature of fees or charges. They'll put out on the market an RFP or RFI to find out who's willing to build and install that system in return for a portion of the revenue that comes back from that endeavor. And this is much like you see in many states where they're selling off things like tollways. So essentially the cost of upgrade and maintenance is defrayed by the private sector in return for a share of the revenues. It can be very risky. It can also produce all sorts of long-term problems if you don't have a clear picture on your costs and the revenue profiles you're dealing with. Bonding is another alternative. Now, this has been a source of discussion for a long time. General obligation bonds, full faith and credit bonds, for technologies are not permitted by state law. But there are other kinds of bonds, and one of the kinds that we've looked at as a possible situation in certain scenarios is revenue bonds, where, again, there is a revenue stream. The state can front the money through the bonding process using its economic leverage, front the money to pay for the system, and then the interest on the bonds until the bonds are retired is paid by directing a portion of fees or charges of the users of that system, much like you would a toll system, if you will. That's an idea that's been used in a number of states. It can be very successful. Again, there's no excuse for not doing due diligence and careful planning in this to make sure it's going to work, but it's another creative alternative to the way we've done it in the past. But
just on that one, bond counsel usually get pretty particular on what you can use bonds for. And I'm sure there's going to be suggestions, for instance, the MAP system. I mean, everybody who looks at it says way overdue to upgrade or do something for it. So are you indicating that, you know, revenue bonds might be a way to take care of some of the state's technology needs?
Mr. Chairman, I'm saying that this is an approach that can work in certain situations, but I think you really need to do the detail analysis to support that generalization or not, and I would leave that up to the management and budget department to conduct that kind of analysis.
Okay.
But the answer is it might be. It's what you have to explore.
All right.
User fees, many systems are supported by user fees directly. Again, if you confront the upfront cost, and we're talking life cycle funding, total cost of ownership, typically you build a major computer system, at any whether the cost is $1 million or $100 million, you can count on spending anywhere from 20% to 25% each year in maintenance and upgrade and operating costs for that system. So when people talk about giving us $10 million to buy a new system, if there's no provision for the cost of maintaining that system, that's a long-term problem that the owners of that system and users of that system have. It is not common for user fees to pay for the creation of a system. It is quite common for user fees to pay for the operation of the system and the maintenance of it. And finally, there's the alternative lease mechanism where you do a turnkey operation, a private vendor comes in and gives you their software and they install it and you pay lease charges. There are some limitations in Minnesota on leasing because of the nature of the fact that the state is incurring an obligation with that lease, not unlike a bonding situation. I'm not an attorney. I don't understand all of the legal ramifications of it. But it is an alternative that has been used in many other states. Like all of the alternatives, there is a cost to cheap systems. And that usually comes in the cost of high fees and lease charges over the life of the system. When the benefits should be accruing, you're still paying the lease costs on that system. Again, not any suggestion that any of these is an aspirin for technology funding, but combinations of them or situational application of it can be a solution to many of the system needs we have. Outsourcing, Mr. Chairman, a discussion we had earlier, should be on the table. There ought to be able to be made a business case for outsourcing or not outsourcing. There are best practices and heuristics that apply in the private sector and also in government about not outsourcing your core business processes. So I think that the idea of doing a business case analysis for a specific situation is critical. You have to look beyond the first instance costs and look at the total cost of ownership and the long-term ramifications of doing that sort of thing. So this is essentially, in 5 minutes, what we spent 3 months exploring a year ago last summer and came up with in our report that we made to the legislature last year. We've heard from other states that essentially they're coming to the same conclusions we came to, not terribly surprising, and each state is trying to solve their problems in a particular combination of those solutions as their situation and their environment and their history dictates. If I'd be more than happy to provide you with other information about the funding study if you want it. I know copies are in the Legislative Reference Library. We can spend more time with
it. I'm sure we'll need that list a little later on when we start looking at options, but it's good to get that information now for us.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Chairman. Moving on, state embarked, if you'll recall, 4 years ago or maybe 5 years ago, the Drive to Excellence program started to identify alternative service delivery mechanisms that showed promise of increasing efficiency and economy statewide in many areas, including information technology. One of the areas that has been productive in many other locations, private and public sector, has been the consolidation of email systems. In the state, which previously had dozens, literally dozens of email implementations, some of which were very robust and some of which were very fragile, we undertook an almost 2-year study working with agencies to identify what were the most productive solutions for that and the best alternatives. And it was not an easy study to do because you have reality that for most users, the two most sensitive systems to replace are their email system and their telephone. Because there's a learning curve to each one of those. They use them every day. They're ubiquitous. They're important to their business. And anytime you start talking about changing them, people get nervous. And with just cause, you have to do it right. Well, we undertook a very lengthy study involving other agencies, looked at all the alternatives from outsourcing to a private vendor to consolidation in one centrally managed email system, to having a couple that people could contract with that were managed within state government, and a variety of other options as well. And they ended up coming down with a choice of a vendor and a central managed solution to try to accomplish the benefits of a centralized email system. And those benefits are significant. You have a centralized scheduling system. You have a centralized directory, which is the core for a lot of identity management and access management tools. You have better chance to intercept spam and malware and other kinds of less than desirable email that you might get. You have chance of identifying significant efficiencies in staff saving and cost of hardware to support these systems. And after doing this extensive business case analysis, they came up with a solution that began implementing this summer goal is to come up with one system for 32,000 state employees by the end of 2010. And the reason it's taking that long is we're going very carefully. This is not a risk-free implementation. Anytime you're replacing an email system with another email system, you run dangers of issues of capacity, issues of maintaining historic records. Agencies have multiple kinds of systems for storing their email records. Some of the systems that are in place have multiple functions besides just email or scheduling, so it's been very much a... First we try it on ourselves to see if it works, then we try it on somebody who's a willing partner, then we try it on the next person, and we try to roll it out in a very supportive manner so that we give them enough end-user support as well as technical support to make it work. So far, we've got over 5,000 of those state employees from the start, the very first pilot project, which included us, to the other agencies that are listed on this slide. And now we're going back and fine-tuning the storage and access requirements to make sure the system runs smoothly. There were bugs in the first implementation. There were some bugs, fewer, in the second implementation. There'll always be a few as you try to bring each agency online. But in general, it's been going quite smoothly, and the agency customers, as a rule, have been very, very satisfied with what has happened. This is an important enterprise-wide application for us, and we're trying to proceed with it on a very professional level. We started out with 30 email systems. Now we're going to one email system. 200 and plus servers. We'll end up with 30 to 40 servers generally supporting that entire enterprise, and with a much smaller staff to do that. The availability of the system, the backup of the system, the redundancy of the data protections and all that will be guaranteed now, which was not always the case with some of these smaller systems. Security will be stronger. The ability to do scheduling across agencies and communications across agencies. And if you work in our kind of environment where we routinely share information with 30 different agencies, the differences in formatting and the nature of the messages communicated from one agency to another creates an enormous extra workload every time you try to exchange information with the agencies, much like Senator Betzel was referring to earlier. Having a common directory means we can identify who messages are going to accurately and also use that as a basis for other ways of directing transactions that we have to do within state government. It is, in most cases, throughout the transition process, it has worked well. There have been some exceptions where it has not worked well in areas we're still trying to make it work smoother, but it is, when we're done, we'll have a system that can not only be accessed from any state desktop, but also equally well from the web. So if you're a user out in a remote area or somebody who's out in the field working with clients, you can get your email messages, you can do your scheduling, you can make contact with references, all using wireless web. And it comes into play very nicely in this day and age where increasingly mobile platforms are the way work is being done. And our office is no longer limited by the 8 to 4:30 and the four walls of the state office building.
What's the one system you've got? You've got one email system. What, is there a particular program?
What we chose is what is essentially one of the major international market standards. It's Microsoft Exchange is the server and Microsoft Outlook.
Okay.
I'm willing to bet for most of you, unless you're on a Macintosh platform, that's the email you have at home. Only it's in a more robust form because it's the enterprise version of it. In the past, I think about, I'm not sure of these percentages, but they're roughly right, something like 55% of state agencies were on Outlook, another 40% or so were on GroupWise, another smaller percentage were on Lotus Notes, and then you had some that were on Gmail and Yahoo Mail and individual clients. Now they'll all be consolidated in one format and one methodology when this project is complete. We know there are going to be some returns on investment in this area besides economic productivity, cost avoidance, the effectiveness of government, and most importantly, security and disaster recovery. But the full benefits are not going to be realized till everybody's on board, and will not be for another year and a half, basically. We were going to try to show it to you, but we weren't sure what the connectivity was going to be, frankly, here, again, Senator Betzel. But from the web access standpoint, you can log into it off any web browser. It will give you access to your address listings for any state employee, and also to your calendars, and your contact lists, and resource information that's contained on your email system. I've had a chance to make use of that this fall. It's been the first time I've really had to use it, but I was laid up with a broken leg for a couple months, and I managed to function reasonably well in spite of the cats and my grandkids working from home, largely because of the email connectivity that I had through the web. Any questions on the email project or anything else that I can answer? If not, Paul, do you have any?
Are there any questions on what we've heard so far? Mr. Crowder, I do have one question, which is a little bit unrelated, but it was something that somebody brought to my attention, and I said I'd promised I'd get back to you. I did have an individual who actually was interested in getting involved in state OET issues, computer issues, but apparently there's some requirement that you have to have a fairly recent degree in computer training. I'm not quite sure what the requirements are. And this person said, well, you know, I'm too old. I went to school years ago. I've got lots and lots of training, lots of experience managing computer systems. I just don't happen to have a degree in current computer technology, so I can't apply for any of these programs. Is that something that's going? It sounds like a bit of age discrimination in a way is what this person put it to me. So are you aware of anything like that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at my associate over here.
This person said, "I can't apply for any of these jobs because I don't have a current degree in computer technology because I went to school too many years ago. I know current systems, I just don't have a degree in this area."
Mr. Chairman, one of the things in my portfolio is organizational development. I'm kind of the man in charge of everything nobody else is in charge of. Most of the jobs in OET and most of the jobs indeed in technology are based on proficiency, not academic credentials.
Okay.
Now, there's one easy way to sort out a lot of people, because in this economy there are a lot of people available, is by setting first of all a degree, but that degree has to be relevant. For most of our jobs, certification is what's most important. I have a liberal arts degree and a couple of graduate degrees, but I have no computer training, yet I'm considered generally fairly knowledgeable about information systems. I don't know half as much as the technician who's a high school graduate and has achieved Microsoft Network certification, for example. So it really is about knowledge and proficiency. Is it possible to have somebody my age, 62, to come into the system and get a job in technology? Absolutely. Does the fact that the degree is 20 years old exempt them from that? Certainly not. But they do have to meet the proficiency and knowledge requirements of the specific position to get into that in the job. But there's no upfront position, any position that I'm aware of in OET that requires a new degree in IT.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from OET about OET?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would like to thank you all for taking the time to have this discussion on our mission and our business. Appreciate this very much. Like all other agencies, we are working hard to work through these tough financial times. And we are right now in the process of working with our customers and establishing our own priorities to make sure that should there be any budget cutbacks, that we are able to operate and serve them well. We fully recognize, as you must have seen from the extent and breadth and depth of our service offerings from 4,000 various rates for various products and services, that ours is a critical business to the operations of government. And we recognize that state's digital cyber complex will make it effective, and we are working hard every day to make sure that happens for our customers and our citizens. Again, we are open for questions. For anything
maybe,
else
we
that
may
we
see
have.
You again after the governor's proposals come out and see in light of that. So, okay.
Thank you very much. I do have one or two things, members, to go before we adjourn. I made the same mistake that Senator Rust made in her committee, and I forgot to introduce our new page. Tom Sheridan works for the Budget Division, so obviously if you need any assistance on anything, you know, he's here to help you as well. Senator Cohen did talk to me briefly on the floor this morning about the fact that we have the public broadcasting accounts within this Budget Division. But with the passage of the constitutional amendment last year dealing with clean water, arts, environment, and so forth, that apparently is going to affect those issues. And he was trying to see if there was a way to consolidate the public broadcasting funds with some of the other divisions that are going to have a greater share of what's being affected by it. So he's looking at that right now, so we may or may not still have the public broadcasting things, even though that comes under the Department of Administration. But I just want you to be aware that those things are going on. We're not going to meet, obviously, this coming Wednesday because of the legislative conference that's on Wednesday, or next Monday, which is Martin Luther King birthday. So we're going to be off next Wednesday and next Monday. I assume that the next time we would meet would be next a week from this coming Wednesday, but I don't know the schedule yet as to when we're coming back after the break. There is a floor session at 2:30, remember, but that's only a brief session just to pass through a bill that is coming out of the business committee that has to get to the finance committee, and that's the only thing that's going on there. But if you want to go to the floor session, that will be at 2:30. So nothing further? Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.